Good afternoon and welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your presenter for the next hour and a half here on Unbelievable, the weekly show that comes to you as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio, where we bring together Christians and non-Christians for dialogue and debate. And we've got a lively back catalogue of past programmes, all kinds of issues that we cover: ethical, historical, biblical, philosophical, theological, you name it, we've done it on the programme. If you want to find out more, go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I've got an exciting programme for you today. I'll be introducing my guests in a moment's time: David Glass, Peter Atkins, and a little later on in the show, James Croft, and I'll give him an introduction later on. Excitingly enough, though, we're approaching the 10th anniversary of Unbelievable. The radio show has been broadcasting since, I think, something like the 26th of November 2005. And so, well, shortly after that date, we're going to be airing a special edition of the programme in which we'll be looking back at 10 years of bringing Christians and non-Christians and people of different perspectives together for dialogue and debate, as well as hosting a few conferences along the way, doing some live public debates, and all of the other stuff that's gone alongside the show. So as a special part of that programme, I'm going to be inviting you to submit any question you like. You can ask me any question about Unbelievable. It might be something to do with the show, an issue debated, a controversial topic, a show guest, what happens behind the scenes, or anything else. If you'd like to send me a question, I'll aim to answer as many as I can on that special 10th anniversary edition of the programme. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send your question in, and I look forward to seeing what you want to know about Unbelievable. But for the moment, let's get into the subject of today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, David Glass joins me, and today we're asking, do scientific answers explain away God? And joining us also, Peter Atkins. David Glass is a senior lecturer in the School of Computing and Mathematics at Ulster University. He's the author of Atheism's New Clothes, came on a couple of years ago actually to talk about that book, and he writes for the website saintsandskeptics.org. Well, just recently, David's been doing some research on a project sponsored by the John Templeton Foundation called Explaining and Explaining Away. It tackles the common atheist objection that as science explains more about the world, there's less need for God. That science has essentially explained God away. That could be considered a version of what's sometimes called Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is the most preferable. David says that's a wrong way of thinking. We don't need to assume that when there is a scientific explanation that God can't also act as an explanation. They could easily both be true, and I'm sure we'll get some examples of that as we go on in the programme today. Peter Atkins, well known as an emeritus professor of chemistry at Oxford University, has a strong anti-theistic stance. He's been on the show a few times, recently in the summer, doing a discussion with Zach Arden. He says that science has certainly explained away any space God used to occupy as an explanation. So, Peter and David, thank you both for coming on the programme today.
Yeah, oh, my pleasure.
Great to have you both here. Let's talk to you first of all, David. Tell us a little bit about the objection that you're responding to with this work.
Well, first of all, Justin, just let me say that this work, as you pointed out, has been carried out at Ulster University, funded by the John Templeton Foundation. And I've carried it out in collaboration with my colleague, Dr. Mark McCartney, there as well. The project has encompassed a number of things, looking at the nature of explaining away in science itself and in other contexts, not just with respect to science and religion. So there's been a number of different strands to the project. But here, of course, we're focusing particularly on one aspect of it, which was the application to science and religion. And so I suppose, first of all, the idea was just to try to clarify what the conflict is supposed to be, what sort of argument there is from science in favour of atheism. And so the idea, as you've already stated, is that science explains away God by giving an account of the natural world. The more and more it explains about the world, the less and less need there is for God, or at least that's what the claim is, I think. And I think it's important to emphasize that no one is claiming that science and God are logically incompatible. So there's no suggestion that science logically disproves God's existence. Instead, the claim is that science makes God redundant. There's just no longer any need for God. And as you pointed out, this is sometimes related to Occam's razor. When this is applied to science and God, the suggestion is there's no need for science and God if science can explain the world around us on its own. So there's no need for two explanations when one will do. So that's, first of all, I suppose, our characterization of the argument.
Do you agree essentially with that argument, Peter?
I couldn't have put it better myself. I think it's put it with great clarity. And I'm prepared to concede a point right from the beginning, which is that no one can disprove the existence of God. I mean, once you postulate that you have an all-powerful entity that can do absolutely anything at will and is in some sense outside space and time and can do whatever it wants by intruding into the world that it claims to have created, then there's no way that logic can displace that. But what you have to do is to sit back and see exactly what science has achieved by attempting to answer the questions that a theistic view would claim to answer itself. I think, in a word, a theistic explanation is a lazy explanation.
Yes.
A scientific explanation is very difficult to understand, but is reliable.
And when we come to a scientific explanation of something, does that automatically exclude any other kind of explanation, in your view?
Well, in my view, it makes it totally unnecessary.
Yes. Well, so essentially, it sounds to me, Peter, like the research that David is doing is exactly aimed at you and others who take that view that once we have scientific explanations, we certainly don't need God as an explanation. God is, as it were, squeezed out in that sense. Now, so coming back to you, David, tell me what's in a nutshell the way that you respond to this, and we'll obviously open up this discussion going forward.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll do my best. The first thing to say, though, is that I'm delighted we agree in the nature of the argument, because that's one of the things we wanted to articulate as clearly as possible in the first instance before we would try to respond to it. In terms of our response, let me just clarify. I mean, Peter has raised several issues about God as an explanation, God being a lazy explanation. I mean, that's something we can perhaps talk about later. There are certainly other objections to belief in God, and we weren't addressing all of those in our project. We were addressing this specific objection to belief in God, which at least we're agreed in the formulation of. Now, part of the project was to explore how explaining away works in general, including in ordinary everyday scenarios and in science itself, not just in terms of religion. And this type of reasoning has been studied quite a lot in the computer science literature using probability, and we've developed that a bit further as well during the project. We've also tried to identify informal questions that can help us to determine whether explaining away occurs in a particular case. So maybe it would be useful if I give two examples of cases where explaining away does occur and another case where it doesn't.
Okay, go ahead, yes.
Yeah, so the first one where it does occur is, let's suppose you go out in the morning to start your car and it doesn't start. And two explanations spring to mind. One is that it could be due to a faulty battery, and the other is that it could be due to a faulty starter motor. So you don't have much expertise, let's suppose, so you contact your mechanic. Your mechanic comes and examines the battery and says, yes, there's a faulty battery. Now, without examining your car anymore, you no longer need to consider the faulty starter motor, because the faulty battery accounts for all the evidence. And okay, you could be really unlucky and have a faulty starter motor too, but that really would be unlucky. There's no need for both explanations when one will do. So in that case, explaining away seems to work quite well. But let's take another example. Suppose a friend is going to get the train to meet you after work, and you go to meet him at the railway station as planned, but he hasn't turned up yet. Now, this could be explained by his missing the train or because he was delayed at work. Now, let's suppose that you then discover that he missed the train. Would that get rid of the other explanation? Well, no, because the two could go together very easily in this case. being delayed at work could have caused him to miss the train. So learning that one explanation is true in this case wouldn't undermine the other one at all. So explaining away simply doesn't occur in this case.
Okay, so I see what you're saying, that essentially you can have one explanation, but there can be, as it were, an explanation behind the explanation, let's say, or there could be two things that both came together and one explains one aspect of it, another explains another aspect.
Well, I think he was really saying that, David was really saying that there are two possible parallel explanations.
Mm. Is that what you were saying, David?
Well, it could work in different ways because that's one aspect to it. There could be two parallel explanations or one could be an explanation of the other. So in this case, being delayed at work could explain why the person missed the train. So there's several different ways in which two explanations can work together. And again, this is something that crops up, for example, in medical diagnosis and other fields. So this is part of the kind of work that people do on the nature of explaining away in the computer science literature.
Yeah, but in the case that we're actually discussing, the comparable case is that one is that science accounts for everything, and the other parallel explanation that you're proposing is that God did it, and you are claiming that both can exist side by side. I'm saying that, okay, I can't prove that there isn't a God, but I can show that science is capable of explaining everything and thereby make the hypothesis of God unnecessary.
Well, two quick points on that aren't directly relevant to our argument. One is that the idea that science explains everything, Well, I think that would need to be defended, to say the least. But secondly, I'm not claiming that they're two parallel explanations, at least not necessarily. Rather, God might be part of the explanation for science. But I'm running ahead of myself a little bit.
Okay, let Peter respond there.
I think you're probably claiming that the scientific method depends upon the existence of God. Therefore, in a sense, the existence of God is prior to my claim that science is good at explaining things.
Yes, I think that's. I think that would be part of a theistic view. Yes, I mean the basic question we were trying to answer in our research, Justin, was the following: how do we decide in a particular case whether explaining away occurs or not? And what we did was to look at both the formal account of this in terms of probability theory, but also to identify a number of questions that are relevant to deciding in a given case whether it occurs, whether it's more like the car scenario that I described, or whether it's like the friend missing the train. Now, there are a number of questions that are important to answer or to address that issue. And I think one of the most important, I'll focus on one just for the moment anyway, it's basically whether there is a dependence between the two explanations. So in the case of the friend missing the train, there is a clear dependence. Being delayed at work caused your friend to miss the train. Now, the question then is, in the context of science and God, is there a dependence between the two? And my point would be that for this kind of science explains God away argument to work, the defender of that argument has got to show that there is no such positive dependence between God and science. That simply can't be assumed, otherwise it's begging the question. But there are multiple reasons for thinking that there may well be a positive dependence between the two. I mean, I'll not go into the details of it now, but just suffice it to say that there's at least four theistic arguments which point to a strong dependence between God and science. And so if this argument is to work, all of those arguments would need to be refuted.
I don't mind taking on the challenge. If you could tell me one of those assertions, I will refute it.
I mean, but before we get to that, Peter, I guess the question is, are you fundamentally, you know, can you allow the idea that you could have a scientific explanation and another type of explanation as well? Or do you say if you've got a scientific explanation, you simply don't need, shouldn't have another type of explanation?
Well, I think I think the latter comes closer to the view that I have. If you can show that you can account for all there is and why there is all there is, then you don't need to revert to a theistic argument, which, when it comes down to it, is pretty empty anyway. After all, to assert that God did it, or that God provided the infrastructure of understanding, or God chose the fundamental particles, that's such a lazy way of talking about the nature of the universe.
Is it lazy, in your view, David?
Oh, not at all. No, I don't think so. I think the suggestion perhaps that Peter has in mind here is that bringing in God somehow stops science, that there's no need to do science, you just say God did it. But that's just demonstrably false. I mean, we look at the founders of modern science, it was precisely because of their belief in God that they wanted to understand how God had done it. I mean, one way to think about this is that because they believed in a personal God who had created the world, they wanted to understand the mechanisms by which it worked.
Yes,
and furthermore, theistic explanations,
I think Peter just wants to come in quickly.
Yeah, I must take up that point. The fact that early scientists were motivated by a false belief doesn't mean to say that the belief becomes true.
No, but my point is that simply saying that it's a lazy explanation because you wouldn't bother looking for scientific explanations, that's clearly false.
People who
appealed to God didn't stop doing science. In fact, the opposite was the case. It led them to do science.
Yes, but it's still lazy as an explanation. It's lazy in the sense that you effectively throw a towel into the intellectual ring. You say, I can't account for the existence of the laws of nature. Therefore, I assert that God did it. But what science is gradually doing is showing that you can account for the laws of nature and that you don't need to wring your hands and throw in the towel.
Well, I think there are... This leads us on to some of the theistic arguments that I was talking about. I mean, Peter's suggestion here is that science can explain everything, including the laws of nature. But I think this is to misunderstand the nature of scientific explanation. I mean, I think science is a wonderful tool. I mean, I work in science, and I think science is great at helping us to understand the natural world around us. But to try to get science to explain things that it's just incapable of explaining, I think is to misuse science, actually. It's just not the right kind of thing. So, for example, in terms of the laws of nature, science explains things by appealing to scientific laws. But to account for the most fundamental laws themselves, well, that's a starting point. Science just can't explain those.
Right. Well, you see, that's a typical theistic cop-out. I claim that it is on the verge of accounting for the laws of nature. For example, take probably the most important law of all, which is that energy is conserved. Because really that's important, because the entire sense of causality, the fact that one event can cause another, hinges upon it. If energy were not conserved, then science would be futile. So it's a really great law of nature. And I think, David, you're asserting that science cannot explain why energy is conserved.
Well, what I'm saying is that in terms of the fundamental laws, I mean, if we take the four fundamental forces of nature, to explain those scientifically is to misunderstand what's going on, because those are the starting point for science explaining other things.
On the contrary, I think, I agree it's a very important question, but I also would claim that science is edging towards accounting for the laws of nature. And I can justify that if you wanted
to. Let's suppose in the best case scenario that we get a theory of everything from which we can account for all the other laws. Well, that still leaves the question as to why this theory of everything describes the universe in which we find ourselves. Why does the universe happen to be like that? Now, once we get to such a fundamental theory, we can't then go to something behind that to explain it. It's something that is just unexplained by science. And this is not to criticize science, of course, in any way. It's just to recognize limitations. I mean, science is there are all sorts of things that science can't explain. And I think to pretend otherwise is to...
Let's allow Peter, yeah?
Go ahead, Peter. You've asserted that there are several things that science can't explain, but you haven't given an example. What would an example be?
Yeah, I can give you plenty of examples. I mean, we've already talked about scientific laws, but we also have ethical truths. We have the truths of logic and mathematics. We have knowledge about the external world, the existence of the external world, the belief in other minds and so forth. All of these are things that we know, but there is no explanation of, let's say, mathematical truth or ethical truth from science. Science is just not the right kind of tool to explain those kinds of things.
I would entirely disagree. I think, for take ethical truth, which I think is probably one of the most difficult things to talk about, then we look for ethical truth in our evolutionary history. We look at it in anthropology in order to understand. We look at it in psychology. We bring to bear the various branches of science to ask why some acts are regarded as good and others as evil. I don't see an analysis of ethics as lying outside the scrutiny by science.
Well, what science potentially can do, and I think you're right at one level, in that science can perhaps answer questions about ethical behaviour or why people come to act in certain ways. But what it can't do is tell us whether something is good or evil. It can't tell us whether something is right or wrong in any objective sense of that term. So let's take murder, for example. Science doesn't have the capacity to tell us whether that is right or wrong.
Well, it does, in the sense that we realize that if murder is encouraged, then we might be murdered. So it's a survival attitude.
But there's no such thing as
fundamental good or fundamental evil. But what we've come to discover is that the world gets by better if certain aspects of it, if certain commandments are adhered to.
Well, that might tell us that it's useful for certain reasons, but it doesn't tell us whether it's wrong in any objective sense. And
I think this is a key
component of morality is not merely to describe behavior or what would be beneficial, but it's to characterize moral obligations. And a real question, I think this is a point that needs to be taken very seriously, is that in a purely naturalistic universe, a purely physical universe, where do such objective moral values and obligations come from?
From evolution.
My point, though, is that evolution can't account for those. What it perhaps can account for is particular types of behavior, why it's beneficial in certain respects, but not whether it's true or false, whether it's good or evil. The same goes for mathematical truth as well. Mathematical truth is something we assume and use very effectively, of course, in science. It's used for describing the universe from the large scale right down to the quantum mechanical level. But science itself doesn't explain mathematics.
Well, let's allow a response from Peter, and then we'll go to a break and carry on the conversation.
Well, I think I've defeated you on ethics, but I will admit that I can't defeat you on mathematics. I think it's a really deep and very interesting question why mathematics works as such a profound and effective language of description of the physical world. And I think by coming to understand that, we will begin to understand the fabric of reality. I certainly don't think that at this stage of science, we should say, it is something we can never understand.
Well, obviously you disagree that Peter has defeated you on the moral issue, but do you feel like it's still a cop-out to kind of say, as obviously Peter believes it is, to say that God's behind the mathematical laws, or is a better explanation, and so on, of those?
Well, I agree with Peter that the mathematical one is, well, like the ethical one, actually, but the mathematical one is very profound indeed, because I think there really is a significant question as to why mathematics is so useful, why it's so good at enabling us to describe the universe we live in, why is the universe like that? And I think theism provides a very neat explanation for this in terms of an orderly universe that's described by laws that can be captured in mathematical form. Why? Because it's been created by an intelligent mind who has created the universe in an orderly and rational way.
Well, you say that, Peter. I mean, what you're saying, I'm hearing, David, then, is when it comes back, coming back to this question of whether scientific answers explain away God, when it comes to the universe, we might have a description of how the universe came into existence from the Big Bang and through all the evolution of the universe up to the point that we reach today. Yeah. But you still believe God is also a valid explanation for the existence of the universe, because there's, at this profound level, it seems to cry out for some kind of a design explanation as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, let me just mention a few reasons for thinking of a positive dependence between science and God, which is where this argument started. We have cosmological arguments that God is the best explanation of the very existence of the universe, related to the Big Bang, about the beginning of the universe. Design arguments related to the order and laws of science, fine-tuning arguments. Now, my point here is that we've already also discussed ethical arguments as well. And these are interesting discussions, and no doubt Peter and I could discuss them for quite a while. But the point in terms of the explaining away argument that we started with is that there are all of these serious theistic arguments that Peter needs to refute in order for the explaining away argument to work. And my point is just that there are very serious and significant defenders and proponents and those against these arguments on both sides of the debate. And we can't simply assume that none of these arguments work. And Peter needs to do that.
Okay, I'll allow you to come back in again in a moment, Peter. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be hearing from James Croft as well. He's also an atheist. He's a humanist celebrant at the Ethical Society of St. Louis in Missouri. He's got a background in philosophy, and he's going to be giving us his take as well on David's paper on explaining away God. So do come back again in a few moments' time as we continue today's edition of Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
We talk affairs of the heart in the latest edition, following the hacking of Ashley Madison, the website dedicated to infidelity. Also, A Life Less Ordinary. Rachel and Andrew Wilson share their experience parenting children with special needs and how to cope spiritually with the life you never expected. Plus, apps to get you reading scripture again, Bible scholar Tom Wright, comedian Paul Carenza, and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome back to today's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Do stick around if you can. Later on in the show, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Later on as well, of course, the profile is here between 4 and 5. Today, you'll be able to hear from Bob Vanderpats. He's in a conversation with Marcus Jones, and Bob himself heads up a US campaign group for family values, and could be quite significant with the upcoming nominations and presidential elections happening. So that's what to look out for later on this afternoon. If you're interested in anything you hear on today's programme, you can, of course, email in your thoughts. Be delighted to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me your thoughts by email. You can, of course, do that by Twitter and Facebook as well, @unbelievablejb, or facebook.com/unbelievablejb to access the Twitter and Facebook pages of the show. All those links and more available, as well as being able to leave your comments underneath the latest show from the website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievablejb. unbelievable. Today on the programme, we're asking, do scientific answers explain away God? David Glass joins me from Ulster. He's a senior lecturer there in the School of Computing and Mathematics at Ulster University. He's also the author of Atheism's New Clothes and writes for saintsandskeptics.org. But he's been addressing a common atheist objection that as science explains more about the world, well, there's less need for God. As if we get a scientific explanation, we don't need God as an explanation. He's been attempting to rebut that in today's programme. And our other guest so far has been Peter Atkins, well known as an emeritus professor of chemistry at Oxford University with a strong anti-theistic stance. We're also going to introduce into the conversation at this point James Croft. As I've mentioned, he's a humanist leader at the Ethical Society of St. Louis in Missouri. He's got a background in philosophy as well. So coming to you in regard to whether science discounts God as an explanation in the world, what's your take on all this?
My perspective is that it is possible, philosophically speaking, to construct, quotes, explanations which involve something like a God, which would not compete with scientific explanations for the same phenomena. That it is correct to say that it is conceptually possible to construct such explanations. But the reason why it's possible to do that is because the nature of the God hypothesis is so vague and so malleable that you can change it in essentially any way you like, so that in any given circumstance it doesn't compete with a scientific hypothesis. And that doesn't recommend a God hypothesis. That's actually one of its big philosophical weaknesses, because it can be altered so that it doesn't ever compete with any other explanation for a phenomenon. It has very little explanatory power. There's very little about it which, when it comes down to it, actually helps us understand the phenomena in question. And so I think that while David's doing some interesting philosophical work in asking the question, in what situations does one explanation compete with another explanation when you're trying to understand some phenomenon? I don't think it really helps the God hypothesis, because the very reason why the God hypothesis is able to sort of exclude itself from competition with other hypotheses is because it's a very, very vague and weak one itself. And you can see that in all the examples that David gives in the published research that he's done for this project. So, for instance, when you're talking about evolution and comparing it with something called design, it's never specified anywhere in the research what design actually means as a hypothesis, what processes are going on, what mechanisms are involved in those processes. It seems to me that that precisely to the extent to which a God hypothesis is a useful explanation of any given phenomena, which actually helps us understand how it happened, not just who did it, but how it happened, it will compete with scientific explanations. In fact, it seems that David's research confirms that. That seems to be precisely what it's saying. To the extent to which it doesn't actually help us understand the mechanisms involved in a particular phenomenon, then we may say it doesn't compete, but also, to that same extent, it's not a useful explanation.
Okay.
And just to give a very quick example of this, David gives the example in his research of trying to work out why it is our car won't start. And he suggests that maybe we're comparing the reasons because there's something wrong with the engine or because we have a flat battery. And in that case, some of the evidence that perhaps there's something wrong with the engine makes it less likely that we have a flat battery. And so we kind of prefer that explanation over the other one once we've collected some evidence. But if we add in a third hypothesis, John did it. So we have, there's a problem with the engine, there's a flat battery, and John did it. It doesn't seem clear that evidence for either of the first two hypotheses will affect how much we believe it's likely that John did it. And that seems to be what David's arguing, and I
okay.
agree with that, philosophically speaking. But John did it is not an explanation for why your car doesn't start.
Okay.
And so it's true that the first two hypotheses, evidence for them doesn't affect the third one. But the third one doesn't explain the phenomena we want to explain.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let's allow David to respond to that, and then we'll bring Peter in again.
Well, there's a whole range of objections have been raised here, Justin. So let me comment very briefly on how this relates to the work that we've carried out. In terms of James's objection, he seems to accept that giving a scientific explanation doesn't remove the need necessarily for a theistic explanation because it's a personal explanation. What James does is to object to the idea of God as a personal explanation because God is too vague or God doesn't give us a mechanism or something like that. Now, interestingly, notice what has happened. We were focusing on a specific argument that science removes the need for God. James seems tacitly to more or less accept that and looks at a different objection, just as Peter in the earlier part of our discussion moved to a different objection, that is objecting to all the theistic arguments which he thinks he can refute. Now, these are enormous topics. These are other research projects. My point, I suppose, here is that if theism is a plausible explanation at all, and there are plenty of good reasons to think that it is, does science remove the need for theism as an explanation? Does it somehow get rid of God? And I think the arguments that it does are very weak indeed for precisely the reasons we've shown in our research.
But
they are not very weak. They're very powerful indeed. I accepted right at the beginning that you can't disprove the existence of God because, as James says, it's such a slippery and ill-defined concept. But what you can do is to understand how people came to believe that God did it. That is, it's driven by sentiment and the fear of personal annihilation and cultural pressures and history and power grabbing and all the things that go into religious belief. But if you discard those and you're left with trying to understand a mechanism by which the world works, a mechanism how it came into existence, then the only answer is through the scientific method, which is a procedure that depends upon evidence and setting theories into a whole network of understanding. So, as I said before, science is hard work, but it gets there in the end. Religion is simply lazy because its explanations are fundamentally empty.
Well, again, if I can respond to that, two points I think here. First of all, Peter has assumed that because science explains the world around us and gives us mechanisms and so forth, that somehow removes the need for God. Now, again, this goes back to the heart of our argument. He can't just assert that or assume that. He's going to have to show and demonstrate that that's the case. And in order to do that, part of what he needs to do is to show that all of these theistic arguments fail. Now, one point I would make about that very briefly is that this argument that science gets rid of the need for God has a certain appeal to it. It appeals to the success of science and the principle of scientific reasoning, Occam's razor, and it perhaps gives the impression that there's a quick way to circumvent all the more detailed arguments for the existence of God. Our research shows that that simply isn't the case. There's no shortcut. The hard work in showing that all of these other arguments fail is going to have to be done.
James, do you want to come in? I mean, do you agree with what Peter had to say there, that religion is empty in that sense of and a lazy way of thinking about these things?
So I think that the idea that the God hypothesis is explanatorily empty is what I was trying to convey. And I don't think it's actually a different topic. I think it's very unusual to say that a research project that's all about assessing the probabilities of different explanations should be allowed to ignore the adequacy of the central explanation it's seeking to support. I mean, that is a very unusual...
Oh, well, can I just clarify?
I think David wants to clarify
then. Go ahead, David.
Well, I mean, this is just the nature of research, that you have to specify a particular problem that you're addressing. We can't possibly address every research question about the existence of God. Indeed, it needs to be focused. And so the focus of our research was not to support belief in God. Rather, it was to take one particular argument against belief in God, namely that science provides reasons for rejecting God, and to show that this is a poor argument for atheism. There may well be other arguments for atheism that have some force. That wasn't part of our research, but it was to focus on one particular argument, an argument that I think is very poor, and actually I think we're maybe doing some service to atheism here, because I think atheists should give up this argument and perhaps focus on some of the other arguments that have been mentioned.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
I understand that. I do understand what you're trying to argue here. My case here is twofold. Firstly, yes, when you undertake a research project, particularly in the era of philosophy, you have to specify quite tight boundaries because you cannot address everything. But you can't leave out of your consideration an absolutely central conceptual question that's a plank of the entire case. You cannot, in this instance, simply assume for the sake of argument that God provides an adequate explanation, potentially, for these phenomena, and then say, and therefore science doesn't touch it. The question of whether God provides an adequate explanation at all is a central conceptual question. Without answering and demonstrating, because it's highly contested in the literature, you cannot proceed with the rest of the research. It's a central part of your premises for the conclusion you want to draw. You have to justify your premises to make the argument. So I don't think that's legitimate.
Let's give David a chance to respond, and then I'll bring Peter in, because Peter's time is limited, he'll want to have a final say before he has to go. But David, yes, respond to that then.
Well, first of all, the idea that in research you have to justify your premises, that's simply incorrect. You've got to start somewhere. Now, what we're doing is saying that the force of this argument, that science removes the need for God, it starts with the assumption that God potentially could be an explanation, but that it's not philosophical considerations that get rid of the need for God. It's science. It's the developments of modern science. And this is the argument that we think is particularly weak. Now, if there are other objections, the sort of objections James raises, I'm quite happy to discuss that, but that's a different question.
So you're saying the objection James is raising, which is that God is not a satisfactory explanation in the first place, is not within the purview of this research, because the thing you're sort of testing is the claim that scientific explanations displace the God explanation, and the question of whether God is a good explanation is a sort of secondary question that is for a different research project. Is that what you're saying?
That's precisely right. I mean, I have written some material on this, so I'm happy to discuss it.
Sure.
But that wasn't the central issue of our
research. I mean, let's go back at least for the moment then to Peter Atkins, who I think fundamentally does hold the view that you are addressing in this research, David, and that is that simply scientific explanations do displace God. Explanations, that if you've got the scientific explanation, you simply don't need, shouldn't have another explanation going. I mean, this obviously hasn't persuaded you at all, Peter, in the course of the recording we've done so far. Do you acknowledge that there can be more than just, for instance, scientific explanations? Explanations of logic, of ethics, does everything in the end boil down to scientific explanations for you?
Well, it depends what you mean by a scientific explanation. If you mean understanding in terms of, in the light of evidence, relying upon a reticulation of theories, that is, that theories don't just stand on their own, but one theory feeds into another. And science is a glorious illustration of how ideas from one field of human study feed in and support another field. So if that's what you mean by science, then I'm afraid science is unquestionably the better explanation, far better than just lying back and thinking of God.
Mm.
I think it's regrettable, really, if only we could reverse history, that we could get science in early and before religion started to corrupt knowledge. If then it would be up to the religious to come along and peddle their particular wares by saying, look, we know that you can account for just about everything there is in the universe, but we've got a much easier explanation, and it's God did it. You'd be laughed out of court.
Right. I mean, David, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, again, Peter is assuming what's at the heart of this argument. He says that science gives us, he tells us about the power of scientific explanation, which of course I completely agree with. But then he goes on to say that science gives us a much better explanation than appealing to God. Now, this is precisely what's at stake here. Because they're not rivals in the relevant sense. Well, and what Peter has got to do, if he wants to show that science displaces God, is to show that the conditions for explaining away are satisfied. And this is an enormous task. This is why I think this argument won't work. I think there's so much work to be done or so many assumptions to be made that it's going to be really difficult to make this argument work for atheism. It simply can't be assumed. There's probably better arguments that could be used than trying to appeal to science.
Are you making this assumption that David accuses you of, Peter?
I don't think so. I'm just taking the world as it seems to me from an utterly unprejudiced point of view, lying here, looking at the evidence, assessing the evidence, accepting that this purported alternative explanation has arisen from sentiment, misogyny, power, hegemony, you name it, fear of personal annihilation, manipulation. Well, all those things don't convince me that it's
of course,
a better explanation.
But I doubt that's what you're saying convinces you either, David, is it?
Not at all. I mean, this is just an instance of the genetic fallacy. Peter thinks that he can explain religious belief on other grounds, but that doesn't tell us whether there's a God or not. What we've got to look at, if we want to consider that question, is various theistic arguments. And of course, this wasn't the focus of our research, but there are plenty of serious theistic arguments to consider. And as far as theism as a lazy explanation goes, well, I think this just doesn't work, because I think if you look at theism as an explanation in terms of its explanatory power, scope, plausibility over a wide range of features of the universe we live in and of human life and so forth, I think theism does rather well in all of these counts, and in particular, not as a rival to science, but as a rival to naturalism.
Okay, yes, because it's not about science versus faith or a supernatural explanation. It's naturalism versus, interesting stuff. Peter, thank you very much for being on the line with us. It's been a great sport to be involved in the discussion. I appreciate you taking the time.
Right, see you in heaven.
Who knows? Peter Atkins was joining us there as one of the voices, doing things a bit differently today. Got a couple of voices in the programme, and James Croft continues with us though, James. So it's you and David together now, James, for the rest of the time that we've got. Do you go as far as Peter does, James, in his views, which is obviously very dismissive of the role of faith and religion in providing any kind of answers in a satisfactory way? What's your take on that?
I guess my take is this. Firstly, I don't think it's necessarily bad in an intellectual setting to be dismissive of bad ideas. It makes you sound, when you put it like that, it makes you sound like a mean person. But it really is essential to intellectual progress that we sometimes dismiss ideas that don't do what we need them to do. And I think that, although I would express it differently, I'm in broad agreement. I'm not convinced by these arguments. I don't think that they are remotely convincing, actually. There are aspects of the argument that I think are valuable. And I think that, as I said before, there's some use in David's research project in asking the question, precisely in what conditions does one explanation explain away another potential explanation for a phenomenon? Where I think the error is, and I'm speaking here as a philosopher and it can get quite technical, is to think that by demonstrating that there are conditions under which two explanations for a single phenomenon do not compete with each other, you have done something to rehabilitate, for instance, the argument for design in evolution or in the sort of world of biology. And I don't think that follows at all from the argument that's presented. And so I think that it's a bit of a slippery question, this one, because there's some useful philosophical distinctions being made, but they don't do the work that it's very clear David wants them to do.
Well, we're coming back to the question of the scope of your project here again, I suppose, David.
Well, we are. And all I want to say on that is that James says that we haven't, our work hasn't made a case for supporting design or supporting the existence of God. He's right. We didn't set out to do that. That wasn't the purpose of our work at all. It was to deal with an objection to belief in God. And on that point in particular, I mean, maybe to narrow the focus a little bit, I would like to ask James, because Peter clearly does want to support this idea that the success of science removes belief in God or explains God away. And James, I'd just like to ask you, do you think that is a good atheistic argument?
Well, it's clearly happened in the past, and you accept it's happened in your one of the research papers that you published as part of this project. In one of them, you write, evolution may well have a negative influence on design arguments. And there you're directly conceding that there are situations in which scientific theories like evolution do potentially have an impact on design arguments. And we can see throughout history that many specific theistic arguments have been discredited by scientific explanations. There used to be, common in the theological literature, arguments which placed God in direct causal relationship to things which then were explained by science. This has happened numerous times throughout the history of ideas, that theologians have come up with an idea in which God was directly involved in some phenomenon, and a scientific explanation has come and successfully explained it away. And that's part of the reason, because that's happened so many times, that now where specific mechanical explanations which invoke God are used, they are always used in areas where science does not have an adequate explanation already. You see that in the examples that David cites in his research papers. They're all examples which look at how God might be tinkering with probabilities at the quantum level, or how God might be doing stuff with genetics just beyond the horizon of what we understand. And I think that there you have an illustration of the fact that there are cases, as David's research accepts, where there is a direct competition between forms of theistic argument and forms of naturalistic argument.
So given that you could cite examples where science has given a better explanation and in that sense superseded a God explanation, one can understand why people might adopt that as a general principle, I suppose. David, do you want to respond to that?
I have to say, I think that was a very vague answer because, I mean, of course there are certain examples. Somebody might claim that God created life and everything in the universe directly 6,000 years ago, and science undermines that belief. So of course there are cases where science might undermine and discredit a certain type of theistic argument. But what I'm asking is whether in general the success of science should be used as a serious argument against the existence of God. I think that's a different question entirely. And I think our research shows that argument is not going to work. So I'm a bit surprised to hear that GM still wants to try to defend that argument, when I think he should really put his attention on other arguments that might have more mileage in them.
Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with the final part of today's discussion, as well as some of your feedback as well to recent weeks of programming here on Unbelievable. Again, if you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard on the program today, do feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I'll remind you of the other ways to get in contact as well a little bit later on in the programme. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio. Faith Explored brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. I'm the senior editor of that publication. And we often include articles of an apologetic nature. Some of the debates that happen on Unbelievable end up in the pages of the magazine. So if you'd like to get yourself a free sample copy, then do go to the website premierchristianity.com/ free sample. And you can also check out there our blog. We've got a regularly updated blog. One of the things actually that I was sent this week and that I'd already seen in some of the papers was from a listener who wanted to alert me to this research that's come out recently, which purports to show that religious children are less altruistic than children of atheists, atheistic children, if you like. We put up a blog on that, actually, from Heather Tomlinson, who's a listener of the show, a female apologist, and she's questioning the validity of that study. So if you want to check that out, that's at the premierchristianity.com/blog page. We'll come to that email specifically from Matthew a little bit later on in the programme. We'll be hearing some of your feedback as well to other issues that have been raised recently on Unbelievable. But again, if you want to get hold of the magazine itself, see it in its full glory, then go to premierchristianity.com/freesample. Later on today on Faith Explore, between 4 and 5, Marcus Jones speaks to Bob Vanderpats. He's part of a US campaigning group for family values, and he's going to be talking about his perspective on the presidential elections and the Republican and Democrat nominations that are going on at the moment. And if you're coming back for Unbelievable at the same time next week, either on air or via the podcast, then you can expect to hear a conversation between Oz Guinness and Rodney Wilson. Oz, of course, no stranger to the show. He's well known as a social critic and author. Rodney Wilson is an agnostic, and you'll sort of hear his faith story on next week's programme. But they're going to be discussing, why do evangelicals lose their faith? And can we improve the art of Christian persuasion? We're going to be looking at a book by both Oz and Rodney that have come out recently. For the moment, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we've had a really interesting discussion today on the programme, asking, do scientific answers explain away God? Unusually, we've had two atheists, actually, joining us for this. We started out with Peter Atkins, and then James Croft joined in a little later on, and James continues with us now as he interacts with my Christian guest on today's Unbelievable, David Glass. And we've been looking at some research that David's been involved in, sponsored by the John Templeton Foundation, called Explaining and Explaining Away, tackling the common atheist objection that as science explains more about the world, there's less need for God. Science explains away God in that sense. David's been saying why he believes that his research shows that you can have two explanations that don't necessarily compete with each other. And so we needn't assume that when we have a scientific, a mechanistic, I suppose, explanation for something, that God is thereby made redundant as an explanation as well. And James Croft explaining that well, firstly, he's not at all satisfied with God as an explanation, but that there have been examples where you can see scientific explanations superseding where God once, as it were, filled that gap, I suppose. The question I wanted to ask you as we come back to this and continue the last part of our conversation with David, James, is Peter Atkins, who we had on earlier, has been accused by some people of quote-unquote scientism. So the idea that science alone can be used as an explanatory tool. Everything boils down to scientific explanations in the end, anything meaningful or significant. Where do you see that? Because you're a chap who, as far as I can see, although you don't believe in a supernatural element to the world, you might still be tempted to call yourself at some level spiritual. You're involved in you know, meaning and giving people, you know, helping people to grasp meaning in their lives and so on, in your role as a humanist celebrant and so on. So do you take that sort of view that only science gives us kind of the kind of explanations that are really meaningful?
No, I don't take that view. I doubt Peter would take that view if you asked him that question directly. I think that we find meaning in many different ways. Science is clearly a source of meaning. I disagree with those apologists who suggest that science can't be a source of meaning in our lives. I think it clearly can play into the narratives that we tell ourselves about our lives and be a rich source of meaning. I think of people like Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson, who tell a scientific narrative of our place in the cosmos, which for many of us humanists is very rich with meaning. But it's not the only source of meaning, and I don't think I know anybody who seriously advocates that science is the only source of meaning. I think perhaps what's closer to what we would like to say is that in the areas which are which tend to be the purview of science in areas like physics and biology and chemistry and stuff like that, we do want a particularly precise, rigorous sort of explanation to help us understand the phenomena that we're observing so that we can get a sort of handle on it and do something useful with our understanding. And in those situations, I think we're right pretty much always to reject specific theistic explanations because they don't do what we need such explanations to do in those circumstances. I go back to my example about why won't your car start, the flat battery, the problem with the car engine, or John did it. If someone told you with great authority that John was responsible for your car not starting, you might, even if that was true, think, I don't really know still how to start my car. It doesn't actually explain my problem. It is a different sort of explanation, true, but the fact that it's a different sort of explanation also means it's an unhelpful explanation. And I think that that's more the idea that's being got at by those, who want to suggest that we really should be turning to science in these specific areas of our lives where we're looking for particular sorts of explanations.
David, I mean, I know that this does go beyond what the project in question, but do you have any sort of responses to that in general as to the inadequacy that James says there is of the God explanation?
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point that James has made, because James rightly points out that John did it as a different kind of explanation. He also says that it may well be true. Furthermore, there being a problem with the battery or the starter doesn't in any way undermine the possibility that John did it as well. There are different kinds of explanations. And so one is a personal explanation. In this case, John might, for some malicious reason, have decided to damage your car. So the evidence doesn't undermine that explanation, and that's the key point I want to make about science and God. But James then goes further and says that that wouldn't be a helpful explanation, that John did it. Actually, it could be extremely helpful if criminal activity has taken place. That would be very useful to know that that was the case. And after all, isn't it the truth that we're interested in finding? And so when it comes to God as well, again, the point is clear. Science, by explaining things, doesn't undermine God as a further explanation, because God gives us a personal explanation. It's not a rival scientific explanation. But isn't that a remarkable truth, if it is one, that there's a God, one that we would want to know? And wouldn't that be the most important question about our lives, about our place in the universe?
It strikes me, James, that okay, just saying John did it, I would say, agree with you, doesn't seem like a good explanation against, the mechanism being faulty or whatever in your car. But if, say, going down David's line, we had other clues at our disposal that suggested that someone who has a malicious intent against you called John had tampered with your car and made the battery go flat or whatever, then obviously we're talking about an explanation that sort of explains the explanation, if you like, explains the flat battery. There's a guy called John. We've got clues as to his presence and involvement. And I suppose, trying to stretch that analogy to God, that's, I guess, what David's saying. There may be similarly clues that there is a designer behind the universe that explains the mechanisms of the universe and so on. And he's saying, it's not that I don't have any evidence whatsoever for that. Actually, David's quite convinced there are some pretty good reasons to believe that there is an underlying purpose and design to the universe and so on.
Yeah, sure. As I said when I started my first remarks, I understand the philosophical distinction being made between different types of explanation. I understand that they don't always compete. But the challenge is that there's an enormous difference, and this is not a different question to the research David is pursuing. This is a central question. A central conceptual plank of his argument has to deal with this question of what sort of explanation God is, because if it doesn't, it cannot engage in the sorts of comparisons between the God explanation and explanations that do not involve God that his research directly spends pages writing about, there are pages and pages in the published research which compare God as an explanation to other potential explanations in concrete areas of science. So the nature of God as an explanation is directly relevant to his research, and I find it, frankly, astonishing that he thinks it's a different question when it's at the heart of his conceptual case. But that being said, there's clearly an enormous difference between the argumentative strategy that says we can identify an agent known to exist, known to have certain concrete capabilities, which we've observed doing these sorts of things before, which we can describe exactly how they would do them. So, for instance, John and his running down the battery on our car. That isn't just an agent. That's also a mechanical explanation folded in there. And whenever we appeal to an agent in a successful way, we have a sort of implied mechanical explanation folded in there. That's why the appeal works. And the appeal to God, without any mechanical explanation that is ever provided by which God could have done the things God is being appealed to do. And that distinction is enormously important, because without that sort of mechanical implication that we generally fold into any of our appeals to an agent when they're successful, philosophically speaking, that argument has no explanatory power at all. Appealing to an agent that we do not know can do what we're trying to explain, or how they could do what they're trying to explain, is no explanation at all. And it's because of that difference between the God explanation and other agentic forms of explanation which appeal to agents we already know exist and already know have certain capabilities, that the argument doesn't work, that this comparison between non-agent and agent arguments is not a reasonable comparison. And so that's both why it doesn't work and why it's a central conceptual question that has to be addressed in this research.
Thank you for being with us on the programme today, James. I'm going to leave the last word with you, though, David. Do you want to sort of round things up and where you see we've got to today?
Well, I think in terms of the literature, I think there's a real misunderstanding on James's part about the nature of theistic explanation. What we have been looking at is the possibility of a theistic explanation, not in competition or comparing it in a similar way to scientific explanations as rivals, but as a different kind of explanation. Now, James's concern here is that we don't have a mechanism. But this is the way a lot of explanation works. To suggest that it's not an explanation because it doesn't give us a mechanism is just to misunderstand the nature of personal explanation. In many cases, in science itself, we think of quantum mechanics. It doesn't give us a mechanism, or Newton's theory of gravitation. It explains without necessarily giving us a mechanism as to how it works. And similarly with personal explanations, I mean, historians all the time appeal to conscious intentions in terms of explaining events in history without knowing or without specifying any mechanisms by which intentions can result in physical behavior in the world. So I don't think this objection really works. And I suppose finally what I'd want to say is that this still leaves a question as to whether science in some way undermines belief in God, and I just don't think it does. It gives a different kind of explanation, and it doesn't meet the conditions for explaining away God.
We're out of time, gentlemen. We could have gone on, but we've had two really interesting guests joining David and myself for today's discussion. James, thank you for being the latter part of the show, as it were, in your coming to this discussion. So all the very best, gentlemen. Great to have you on. James, if people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
People should visit ethicalstl.org for the Ethical Society of St. Louis, which is the humanist congregation that I help lead in St. Louis, Missouri.
Fantastic. I'll make sure that link goes up with today's program online, and links to your Twitter and so on as well. Thank you also, David. If people want to read a bit more about your research, what's the best place to go?
Well, if they do a search on explaining away at Ulster, they will find a number of publications relating to our research. And also, I have some material on another website, saintsandskeptics.org.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for being with me. I wasn't expecting to get you to persuade each other necessarily in the course of today's programme, or indeed Peter Atkins, but I hope that it's been food for thought for many people listening. For the moment, James and David, thanks for being with me on the programme today.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time now for some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. A quick reminder, though, that in a couple of weeks' time, Unbelievable will turn 10 years old, believe it or not. Now, we haven't been podcasting for quite that long. I think the podcast archive goes back about 7 years or so. But certainly we've been on air for 10 years, or nearly at least. And so in a special 10-year anniversary edition coming up in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be aiming to answer as many of the questions that you send in as possible. So ask me any question about Unbelievable. It could be about a show, an issue that's been debated, a controversial topic, what I think of some of the theological issues we discuss, what happens behind the scenes, or anything else you fancy. Try to keep them short if you can, and that goes for all email correspondence, in fact. The shorter your feedback, the more likely it is to be included, frankly, on the programme. But you can send them into unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do that if you can by the 1st of December, as the show will be airing shortly after that. So unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Ask me any question and I'll attempt to answer as many as I can. Let's go to some of those who have emailed in to that email address about recent shows. I mentioned Matthew Herzl, who got in touch on Facebook, actually, first of all, to say, I'm a regular podcast listener. I've already gone through nearly all your back catalogue since discovering the programme about a year back. I really appreciate the quality of the programme and your ability to parse complex topics well and fairly. It's been an immense help to me as I've gone through the very difficult process of deconversion from a fundamentalist faith. It's so rare to find a place that examines big issues honestly. I don't think I'll ever return to faith, but the door is always open. Thank you so much for the work you do. And you pointed me in the direction, as I mentioned earlier, Matt, of that study which suggests a negative correlation between religion and altruism in children. As I say, we've put up a blog on the Premier Christianity website that sort of rebuts some of the findings. But in any case, great to hear from you. Could be an interesting discussion topic for a future show. Tony Rome in Idaho, USA says, listening to the latest podcast on whether a godless society can flourish, I'm wondering why there was no discussion about the examples of godless societies in current or recent history, like North Korea or Russia. It seems to me that communists have attempted to create this atheistic nirvana. And look how that's worked out for the billions of people who lived or died under oppression. And another person says, I enjoyed your debate on whether it would be better or not to live in a godless society. However, Christ himself railed against the religious of his day, and there seemed to be limited attempts in the discussion to differentiate between certain ills of religion and what God would want for individuals in the world. However, does history not have some dire warnings from countries that have tried to stamp out belief in God, for example, North Korea? So in a similar vein there to Tony. In fact, just to, as a reminder for those who perhaps aren't aware of which show we're talking about here, this was last week's programme in which Alex Gabriel, our atheist guest, discussed with Rich Park, our Christian guest, whether we can build an atheist, godless, flourishing society. And in a sense, it was quite a philosophical discussion in many ways. Graham from Whitstable Skeptics says the scenario where half the population wanted to cause pain and half wanted to receive it was an interesting philosophical discussion and can indeed reveal the basis for some of our belief systems. But it's far removed from reality. Most people want to live a quiet, peaceful life, respecting other people and harming no one. They are that way not because they're obeying God's rule book, but it's the result of humans working out how to live in a community over thousands of years. These experiences have hardwired behaviours which help to make communities work. Otherwise, human society would never have survived. All social animals have developed similar ways of interacting with each other, some quite complex. Elephants and ants don't have scripture to rely upon. I get that. We've had that kind of debate quite often, I suppose, on the programme. I think the point that Rich Park was pressing was whether, even if you do believe in some kind of goal to a flourishing society, you still have to have some kind of metaphysical foundation on which to agree what it means to be a flourishing society. Whose definition are we using in that sense? But those are just some of the responses that came in to last week's programme. The one before that has generated and continues to generate a lot of response. It was two views on suffering. And we heard from, if you like, a Calvinist view, what we termed the blueprint view, versus a view which is more commonly associated with a free will view or open theism view, that of the idea of divine warfare being responsible for a lot of the suffering in the world. It's not laid, at, as it were, at the feet of God in that sense. Now, here's Jonathan Mitchell, who's an assistant professor out at Austin State University, says, why do we tend to assume that when bad things happen, it's some sort of punishment? The gospel of Christ says that the awesome wrath of God towards sin was poured out onto his son at the cross. So I don't think God punishes his children. Yes, he disciplines them, but it's rarely some cosmic plague of skin disease. Even the disciples tried to ask Jesus about some sort of karma theology. Is this man's blindness because of his sin or his parents? I can imagine Jesus shaking his head as he corrected their theological error. Does God orchestrate suffering and difficulty? Well, Kurt said, sometimes no, but we don't always know the reason. Ken said, yes, but we don't always know the reason. There's the mystery, the unseen. God's ways are not our ways. Both debaters agreed, this world is broken. I thought Kurt summed it up well when he said, we agree on many things, but our difference is in the mysterious, or something like that. Unfortunately, it took almost an hour into the debate before someone began to talk about the cross of Christ, and I'm not sure the word redeem or its derivatives were ever mentioned. As much Chandler has said before, good news must invade bad spaces. We know bad stuff happens. That's where he meets us and weeps with us. He takes the bad things we do and the bad things that just happen to us and redeems them. How? I don't know. When? Sometimes we witness it, others perhaps in glory, but we see it time and again in Scripture. Anyway, you say you love the podcast, aims to always keep you thinking, mission accomplished. Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan. Jeff from Canada on that debate between the warfare and blueprint view of suffering and God's sovereignty and so on said, I was not quite sure of the benefit of the debate outside of probably raising the topic of God and suffering for a potential future debate that supports or denies God's existence on the basis of suffering. From a theological standpoint, both views can be justified together without eliminating the other. So, warfare versus blueprint, as I see and understand, neither and both are part of the reasoning behind suffering in God's eyes. We must first ask the question, why suffering exists in the world? The straight answer is it's the byproduct of the problem of sin. Both views work into God's ultimate plan of redemption. So, warfare, it's safe to conclude that God initiated Satan's ultimate demise back in Genesis when he declared enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Since then, from a spiritual perspective, there's been a battle to prevent God's solution to sin, Jesus Christ. The blueprint model, nothing comes to God as a surprise. As Professor Craig would say, God's middle knowledge would allow him to know what choices free creatures would make, therefore permits him to use these free choices to accomplish his ultimate end, redemption, and the restoration of man, then the final judgment of sin. Thank you, Jeff. Obviously, what you're quoting there is, again, another view in that sense. I don't think it is the blueprint view, the middle knowledge or Molinist view. So, again, that's another one that you could feed into the question of suffering and God's purposes and so on. Mike Rand says, I've been in the kitchen listening to the programme on suffering through the wonders of the iPod. I always listen to you while doing the washing up. Makes a boring job a lot easier. I enjoyed the intelligent design discussion, but felt I had to write in response to the final segment of the show. I just can't believe that a learned and qualified biologist can believe that genetic illness and degenerative flaws are due to the Christian concept of the fall. My biggest block to becoming part of the Christian church is this 4th century theology surrounding Jesus dying in order to that we may be forgiven of our sins. I wish someone had asked Jonathan McClatchy at what point Adam and Eve came into the world. Were they designed as whole humans in the form we now know, or had they evolved from single cells over millions of years, as the majority of biologists and religious leaders now accept? Surely he must accept that evolution and the connecting similarities of DNA involving so many animals and plants on this planet have destroyed the myth of Adam and Eve. You carry on in like manner and say, sorry to bleat on, but it's my stumbling block to faith. Well, Mike, I've said to you, I responded to you and said maybe it would be interesting to come on and discuss this stumbling block you have to faith at some point. Perhaps we'll just wrap up with one more, going back to the old issue of Calvinism and Arminianism, free will and so on. Here's Carla in Canada who writes in to just say it was a great show to get you thinking. Here's a devotional I wrote on the topic a while back. A Calvinist arrives at the gates of heaven. He sees that there are two lines going in. One has a sign that reads predestined and the other free will. He naturally heads to the predestined line. While waiting, an angel comes and asks him, "Why are you in this line?" He replies, "Because I chose it." The angel looks surprised. "Well, if you chose it, then you should be in the free will line." So our Calvinist, now slightly miffed, obediently wanders over to the free will line. Again, after a few minutes, another angel asks him, "Why are you in this line?" He sullenly replies, "Someone made me come here." And you say, "This is a heavy topic in the Christian realm of discussion. I thought this joke was actually quite hilarious. And to me, it proves a point, actually a few points about the two sides. Jesus says to us, 'Look, I'm standing at the door and knocking. If anyone listens to my voice and opens the door, I'll come in and we'll eat together.' I think it shows us how interwoven the two points of view actually are. In my humble opinion, I don't think you can separate them. We may throw the dice, but the Lord determines how they fall, as Proverbs 16 says. I think God has got this whole predestined and free will thing so perfected that the two work absolutely beautifully in unison, that they accomplish his will just as he desires. I totally believe that it's both going on at all times, but God knows in advance what our choices will be. He knows our every thought and word before we speak it." Again, apologies, I can't read out the whole of what you've written there, Carla, but interesting thoughts as well. Thank you for listening to today's programme. I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion, and I hope you can come back again at the same time for next week's show. You're unbelievable. And next week on the show, I'm joined by Christian thinker, writer, social critic Oz Guinness. He's got a new book out called Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion. He's going to be in discussion with Rodney Wilson, who's an ex-Christian, and his book is called Killing God, and it involves a number of interviews he's done with ex-evangelicals and why they lost their faith. So next week, Oz and Rodney will be discussing why do evangelicals lose their faith and can we improve the art of Christian persuasion. Hope you can come back for that at the same time. In the meantime, The Profile is here next. Thanks for being with me today.